Having a child diagnosed with any form of pediatric cancer is always devastating news. And being diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia at the age of 2.5 only adds to the problem, as this is the most difficult form of leukemia to both treat and cure. On today's podcast, we will learn just how hard this situation can become, as Autumn Gentry will talk about her daughter Isla, who, except for a brief moment of optimism, was dealt one bad break after another before her passing on August 11th of 2020. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Acute myeloid leukemia is the most difficult form of pediatric leukemia to treat and to cure. And on today's podcast, we will learn just how difficult this form of pediatric blood cancer can be. As I would now like to introduce Autumn Gentry to my audience and welcome her to my podcast. It's an honor to speak with you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your introduction to pediatric cancer began almost immediately after you took your then five-year-old son Sawyer and your 2.5-year-old daughter Isla to the zoo in July of 2019. And when you returned home, Isla could not remove her shoe. And when you pulled it off, you noticed that there were freckles up and down her legs. And you also remembered noticing that she had had freckles on her chest and her back when you had given her a bath. What were your thoughts at the time about seeing these freckles?
I just thought that she was really similar to me. I have fair skin and get freckles. And when I first was seeing these, I just thought, oh, she's going to have skin like mine. But then that day when I had really noticed them all over her legs, it felt like too much. It was very concerning. And I got them settled and kind of jumped on Google, like, you know, every mom does. And it was nothing but bad things that were really coming up. So that's when I kind of started spiraling a little bit.
Now, you also had noticed that Isla had bruises on her hips and legs. And after going on Google, which of course no one should ever do, but we all do it anyway, you took Isla to her pediatrician, who at least initially, upon seeing her, assured you that there was no need to be worried. What did he say about Isla's health during the visit that for at least a time allowed you to feel better?
He said that she was very well-seeming. He said this is not a sick child. At the worst, it's probably some sort of infection. You could tell he hadn't really seen it before. He had pulled in a nurse practitioner to kind of take a second look because he wasn't entirely confident. And they had stepped out of the room and talked for a pretty long time and did a little extra research that wasn't really typical of something that you would normally see in your average doctor appointment. And when they came back and he had said, you know, I just want to assure you it's nothing scary like leukemia or something. But we should probably just do our due diligence and get a blood test just to make sure that we, you know, have turned every stone.
Which is exactly what the pediatrician did, ordering the blood test. And after that, you were on your way home. Later that evening, you discovered that you would miss 7 phone calls plus a text from Isla's pediatrician, which, of course, is never a good sign. And upon your call back to him, he answered the phone on the first ring. What news did he give to you and your husband, Michael?
He basically immediately said, I need you to bring her to the emergency room immediately. She has leukemia. He really didn't beat around the bush. He was pretty direct, pretty firm, and said, this is an emergency. You need to leave your house right now.
So you were told that you needed to bring Isla to Children's Wisconsin Hospital in Milwaukee, which is just a few miles from your home in Wauwatosa. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yep.
So you were there within an hour. I'd like to know how terrifying and how confusing it must have been for both you and Michael to be told this news just a few hours after you were told that in Isla's pediatrician's opinion, she was healthy.
There really cannot be a worse feeling. I remember when the doctor was still on the phone, I immediately, before my head could even catch up with what was happening, I just ran to the bathroom and started throwing up. It was like my body could feel the devastation of the news before my head could even wrap itself around it. I remember just continually throwing up. And we gathered my son to have a friend come over and watch him, and grabbed her. And I remember just like crumbling in the front yard and throwing up again. I also at the time I was 8 months pregnant. And that even continuing when we got into triage in the emergency room, I remember just being on the floor and my body just couldn't stop throwing up. It was this adrenaline rush of terror, that before your head can really understand what is happening, just your body reacts.
I'm curious to know, after the blood test on your way home, were you at least assured that they were doing everything possible to check out what was going on with Isla, and the fact that he had said that he was healthy? Were you at all concerned anyway that there might be something there when the blood test work would come back?
Honestly, cancer wasn't even crossing my mind. In fact, I didn't actually at the time even know that leukemia was a type of cancer. I just knew it was a bad disease and kids lose their hair, but it wasn't categorized in my brain as cancer. But he had really reassured me in that way. So that wasn't hitting me hard. It was just like, well, some kind of unknown infection. That's a little scary. But I remember afterwards, my husband picking me up from the hospital, and we went out for tacos with our kids, and just because we were hitting dinner time and we just were a little more relaxed and felt okay. It doesn't cross your mind that like, that the worst could actually happen to your family. I felt reassured enough to be, you know, that the worst doesn't happen to your kid.
It always happens to another family.
That's
what everybody says, of course. And it's very rare to have a child with cancer, obviously, until it happens to you.
Yeah.
And then things change dramatically. Now, when you were told that Isla had the form of pediatric blood cancer, which was diagnosed as acute myeloid leukemia or AML, what were her doctors at the hospital saying about the treatment that she was about to go through? And at that time, had they even discussed their thoughts on where this treatment would lead to? And if they did they have a positive tone in what they were telling you?
Yeah, they were very reassuring that that leukemia is very treatable, that she is standard risk, and that the average length of treatment is about 6 to 9 months, that it's very aggressive. So that's just why the treatment has to be equally aggressive. They said, don't Google. So I didn't. And it's probably a good thing that I didn't, because I did not know that leukemia is a pretty bad one, that there's really a 50% chance of not relapsing. And I remember almost feeling reassured that it wasn't ALL, because I remember thinking, oh, that's a really long course of treatment, like almost 3 years. I'm sure glad that she has AML, not realizing that it's a much lower chance of survival with AML.
And I also think that even though it's shorter treatment than ALL, it's also a very, very difficult treatment, yeah, as you were soon to find out. Now, can you talk about the 6 to 9 chemotherapy treatments that Isla had to undergo, with each one requiring approximately a 6-week hospital stay, followed by a couple of weeks at home to recover before the next round of chemotherapy would begin?
Yeah, that was a really, really intense time. A month into her treatment, or on her second round, I'm sorry, we had our third child born. So that kind of only increased how intense this time was for our family. We were very separated. My 5-year-old would be at school all day. I would be in the hospital with Isla and our baby all day. At 5, my husband and I would switch in the valet area. And I would go home to be with my 5-year-old. He would be overnight with Isla. And then the next morning, we'd switch in the valet area again. And it was that way for really what ended up coming out to be about 10 months. So just the separation and the rigor of the schedule was incredibly intense for us as the family. But then for Isla, the treatment itself was very, very aggressive. But honestly, she handled it so well. I cannot imagine any adult handling this type of treatment the way that she did. She would be up in the halls, just running around, chasing nurses, chasing doctors, with an evil villain laugh, using her magic wand in the hallways, trying to turn off the lights, and the nurses flickering the lights, acting like she has magic. I mean, she was just kind of the little light of this unit. And so you just would never have known that she was so, so sick. There were certainly times where the treatment hit her more intensely than others. She would get really high fevers. She would get really bad allergic reactions to different medicines. The cytarabine affected her eyes, in which she would have periods where she had to be in the total dark because her eyes were so bothered from the treatment. She would just lay there with her eyes closed and all the shades drawn for days on end when it would get really bad. So we certainly had our moments where the aggressive treatment really slammed her. But overall, she would just push through like kids do.
Yeah, kids are so resilient. And most of the time, what they're doing is they're actually teaching their parents how to respond to the situation and making them feel better. Obviously, when they're acting that everything's going to be okay, it's just something that's certainly was in Isla and is in so many pediatric cancer patients.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the separation you talked about is very difficult, but for you, you had to, you know, take care of your new son, and then you had to be in the hospital all day, and Michael had to work, and then he would go to the hospital to replace you. He never came home, basically, for 10 months, and added to that, Sawyer and Isla were really like best buddies, and he really never got to see her.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard, especially when in the wintertime, the entire hospital has flu policies during the flu season. So especially in this unit, kids were not allowed to visit the unit at all once the flu season hit. And that was really, I believe, early November. So between November on, he wasn't allowed in the hospital. And of course, in March of the next year is when COVID hit.
Well, even before then, things really got, you know, very, very difficult, even more difficult than the beginning, in that around Christmas time of 2019, Isla relapsed, which is obviously a warning sign. Were there any signs that she was relapsing? It had only been 5 months since her original diagnosis, or did the relapse was it diagnosed after some sort of a routine scan?
She was getting routine CBCs, I believe daily. They were checking her blood levels. And it was around, it was just before Thanksgiving. We were going to be really soon from the treatment and we were going to be home for Thanksgiving. And in one of her routine CBCs, it picked up on some blasts in her peripheral blood, which raised a flag. I remember seeing that in her CBCs when we would get it through my chart on our phones in the app. But then not having an explanation for it and trying to get a doctor to come see us and explain what was going on. And I remember not being able to get straight answers for so long. And they were really confused because she was still in treatment. She was still actively getting chemo. And it wasn't behaving the way that it should. It was not, if I believe correctly, it was not in her marrow, but only the peripheral blood. So it just wasn't behaving in the way that it typically would. And it went on for weeks that they were consulting with other doctors. I remember they brought it up at a conference of hematologists, and they were all checking her blood samples and discussing, and our doctors were wonderful about reaching out through the Children's Oncology Group to other institutions for second opinions. But it wasn't until right before Christmas, so about a month of back and forth, that it was confirmed that she had officially relapsed. For about a full month, and no one quite knew what was going on. And that entire Christmas season, it was absolutely terrifying to not know and not to have answers.
As bad as finding out that there was a relapse, it's just as bad not to know on a daily basis what's going on. And of course, when you have the uncertainty, that I would imagine plays many tricks with your mind during that period.
Yeah. It was pretty awful. And also just to, you want to have a lot of confidence in the oncology team that's taking care of your child. When they don't seem to have the answers, that makes them feel so much more human. And, you realize how unknown cancer truly is and how every case is so unique that it's not cut and dry.
No doubt about that. But at the time, you needed, or Isla needed, a bone marrow transplant after the relapse. Fortunately, Sawyer, her older brother, was the perfect match for her. Unfortunately, being able to perform the transplant proved to be almost impossible, as Isla suffered from infections, some of which caused her to have a temperature as high as 105 with trips to the ICU. She was also becoming increasingly resistant to her chemotherapy regimen. Can you talk about this period in which I'm certain that the frustration level, which was already high enough, had probably gone off the charts when you just didn't know if the bone marrow transplant was going to happen?
Yeah, it was awful. And it was very much living week by week with new information, new questions, new cocktails of chemo that have never been tried on kids. When the standard regimen failed, they really had to throw the book at her to figure out what would bring her disease level low enough to receive the transplant. Every 2 weeks we were checking in on her levels, because we wanted to get her to transplant as soon as possible. But it kept increasing, and they would try different treatments that there had been some success in older adults. And so they would bring her various treatments. I remember there was one particular medicine. It was awful. It only came in the form of these giant, giant pills, because they were made for adults and they had never been given to a child before. And we were trying to figure out how to administer it to her. She did not have an NG tube yet. It had to be taken orally. And so I remember the pharmacist would take these giant pills and just dissolve it in water and kind of bring it down to this thick, thick sludge. So if you imagine taking multiple horse pills and just tasting them in the form of this thick sludge, she had to slowly drink a large tube of it twice a day. And would almost always throw up multiple times through taking it. And I remember trying to feed her her favorite snacks in between each sip of it and bribing her and begging, and it just being the most traumatic time, specifically with that medicine. But it was just constant things like that. Just begging her to do things out of desperation to get to this transplant, being willing to try literally any kind of medicine, no matter how hard it was, to get her there. And things would definitely get scary when she would get multiple different infections. We thought she had a fungal infection in her lungs. Just every time we would come up to almost transplanting or getting just low enough, there would always be some sort of infection. Her organs were healthy and strong, so that was never the concern, but it was becoming an increasing concern knowing that she was trying all these experimental treatments and really having no certainty how it would affect her organs. So it was all just terrifying. We landed in the ICU several times during this time. And even when we were almost getting to transplant, she was never in remission. It was always, she had a certain percentage left. So it would always be incredibly risky to transplant no matter what. So we were always having the same conversation of, well, she has this low amount of cancer still. Do we want to try to wait and see if another treatment will bring it down lower? Or do we just transplant with a high risk? It was never a confident decision. So we were always having to remake this decision of what risk we were willing to take.
Well, things really, were difficult and bad and frustrating and uncertain. And then COVID hits.
Yeah.
In March of 2020, what challenges, in addition to what you were already going through, did the COVID situation provide for you?
It was so much. All the shutdowns began when we were at home for a brief period of time. And I remember while everyone was complaining about being stuck with their families, we were just grateful to all be in the same house under the same roof. I remember feeling very strongly how grateful I was. But then we had to go back into the hospital, and it was before there were any, standards in place yet. I remember just walking back into the hospital and seeing people in these full suits blocking the doors and just feeling like I had entered into some post-apocalyptic movie. Yet when I remember an NG tube getting placed the day that we came back into the hospital and this team of nurses leaning in over her face and me freaking out that no one is wearing a mask, and because those things weren't in place yet, and just not knowing, are we going to be okay? Is this safe? Should I even have nurses around us? And then restrictions came into place, and that both brought comfort and also just a whole new sense of paranoia. I think the hardest thing during that time was that we couldn't get as much support from friends and family. We felt relatively safe in the hospital, to be honest, because there were such tight restrictions that it really did protect us quite a bit. We were already used to living in the immunocompromised world, but we could never get relief. No one could ever step in to spend a night with her. No one could watch our other kids. It was very intense. And during that time, my brother and sister-in-law moved to Milwaukee from Chicago to help us. They just kind of uprooted because they knew that we would need help. And so they just kind of became part of our bubble. And offered us the childcare that we needed and all the extra support that we were desperate for.
Certainly that turned out to be a big help for you, I am sure. Now, the only good thing, I guess, that was happening during that period was that Isla's body was becoming strong enough so that the transplant, which was certainly uncertain for so long, looked like it was going to happen. And as they began the transplant workup before the actual procedure, Isla had new tests. And what did those tests show?
They had shown that her disease had grown yet again. And it was at a point that was just simply too high for her to transplant. And I remember saying, like, this was after a full day of the workup for the transplant. Like, they had already harvested my son's bone marrow. She had gone through all of the CT scans and the heart checks and all of the things. And at the end of the full day, they came in with the test results. And I remember just asking them, okay, well, what's the next thing that we're going to try? You're just kind of get into this rhythm of just assuming there's another thing, that there's always some new experimental thing. And they said, no, we're like at the end of the road here. There's nothing else. There are no other experimental options we can try. All there is clinical trials at this point.
How long after that did you find out about Lurie Hospital in Chicago that they did have a stage one immunotherapy trial? And Isla was one of six children at the time, I think probably in the world, that was going to try or had tried the procedure. How did that trial work out?
Well, we found out immediately in that meeting when they told me that there were no other options. They said, this is the only other option, is this trial. And I remember she didn't quite qualify yet. She needed to gain a little bit of weight. So for over the course of, I believe, 2 weeks or so, we just kind of put her on this super high calorie regimen so that she would gain a couple more pounds. And I remember going to the hospital at Lurie for the initial check-in to see if she would qualify. And looking at the nurse who was about to weigh her and thinking, like, this is the moment that my child either has a shot or not, is just getting on the scale. And I said, does she have to wear her shoes or not? And she just looked at me hard and said, keep the shoes on. And she got on the scale and she was the exact number of kilograms to qualify for this trial. And so we started the trial. It was a continual drip of flotetuzumab, which is an immunotherapy. She had covering the full 2 months that we were on this trial, she had heart monitors and things covering her entire back. She had a PICC line in her arm. She had a central line in her chest. She had her fingers and toes were hooked up to things 100% of the time for 2 months. She was just covered in cords and on a continual drip of this immunotherapy. So that was hard, but the positive was that there were quite literally no negative side effects to this therapy. She had more energy than ever. The worst that she got was a rash, and it didn't even bother her. It just were spots all over her. But she was completely well-seeming and energetic and herself during this treatment. It was amazing. And every time they checked in on her level of disease, it was dropping so much. After the first month, they said, yes, like, this is working. She was the first child to get any test results back in the world for this therapy. And so there were oncologists around the world that were just kind of on pins and needles waiting for her test results. And it was incredibly exciting when they were positive. And her disease was rapidly dropping. So we decided another 2 weeks. And her disease, after a month and a half, was so, so low that we were actually considering transplanting at that point. She was so healthy. She was strong. Her disease was incredibly low, still present, but very, very low. I'm having a hard time remembering the exact numbers, but low enough that we were willing to do it. But the oncologist wanted, because it was so promising, wanted just 2 more weeks on this therapy so she would have a much higher chance of success once she transplanted.
Now, after hearing such disappointing news for such a long period of time, how good did it feel that because of the immunotherapy trial, Isla's leukemia was down, I think, to about 2%. She's going to be able to go home before the bone marrow transplant, able to ride her horse for a day. And for a time, you could all be together in a positive atmosphere. How good was that feeling when this was going on?
We were so proud. And we just felt on top of the world. I just felt like she was a true pioneer, that her going through this trial and going through everything that she had been through would do so much good for other kids, that this was going to give other kids a fighting chance. I just felt proud that she was my daughter, that she had gone through so much and that she was going to come out on the right side of this. And that at the same time, it was going to help so many people. We were beyond ready for good news, for sure. And we were on cloud nine. It was incredible. And she had always wanted to ride a horse. And so the nurses at Lurie in Chicago found this horse farm that would be able to help her. And they were going to give her a day to finally ride a horse. That was like her dream. And we wanted her to be able to do it before she got her transplant.
Well, unfortunately, whatever good feeling you might have had dissipated quickly, as after Isla's final spinal tap, she was in quite a bit of pain. She could not walk because the spinal tap had caused a hematoma at the base of her spinal cord, which was slowly paralyzing her. And her leukemia level had returned to 30%. That must have been as devastating as anything that you had heard over the past several months.
Yeah. At Lurie, she had her final spinal tap. And yes, she was in a great deal of pain, but they thought she might have just been a little extra sore. And so they sent her home. And the next morning, she woke up unable to walk. So we had brought her into the emergency room to see what was going on. And they had discovered that there was a hematoma at the base of her spinal cord. And they were discussing whether we should operate or not. And in that same room, within the same hour, an oncologist came in, not knowing what was even going on with us in that room with her spinal cord, and had come in and said that her leukemia had grown to over 30%, and they gave her 3 weeks to live. There is no way to describe the anguish that we were feeling in that room. I remember crying and feeling like an animal, just no control over the feelings going through my body, and hearing my husband wail in that way. It was every bit of terror, every frustration, everything that had built up over the last 10 months or so just came out at that time. And we were 100% defeated, and nothing can prepare you for that kind of thing. And to know that you have weeks with your child, they will always be in pain.
The last few weeks of Isla's life, you mentioned being in pain. Was she in constant pain until the end, or did she have any moments of comfort which perhaps might have given you a little comfort when she didn't seem to be in as much anguish.
Not really. Immediately, they had put her on some pretty high steroids, which did give her some initial relief, enough that we went to Cape Cod because we wanted her to see the ocean before she died. And so I remember during that time, she had some relief from her pain, but the steroids just were making her angry. So that whole time, her behavior was very different than what was typical of her. But then when we came home from that trip, we had about 2 weeks before she was going to die. And at that time, pain became uncontrollable. Daily, we would have consultations with her palliative care team. And every day, I remember I had this spreadsheet of all of her medicines that I would have to change every single day. Hourly, there were multiple medicines I was giving, and just nothing could keep up. It was just growing too much. And I never really got clear answers if this was typical of someone at the end or if this was just related to her spinal cord issue. No one really knew. All of our hospice workers would quit on us after one day because they couldn't handle being around a child who was dying. So we never got consistent hospice care. And so because of that, no one really ever knew what was typical, what was normal, what was the spinal cord issue, what was the process of dying, what was the leukemia. It was terrible. At the very end, about a week before she was to die, we had increased her medicine so much that she was basically just put into a deep sleep as a result of all the medicines. And at that time, I'm hoping that she had relief. I guess you never really know.
Among the very distressing story and journey that Isla went through, you just said something which really triggered. I don't know if the word anger is the right word, but people that are hospice workers, they came for a day and they left because they couldn't handle a child dying. Isn't that why they are hired and trained? I mean, it just seems unfathomable to me that something like this would happen more than once, if at all.
We felt completely abandoned during that time. Which, of course, this is the time that a family needs the most amount of support. We had spent the last almost year of her life, which is about a third of her life, in the hospital. We were ready for her to just be home and be with her family. And if we were to be in the hospital because of COVID, like, her brothers couldn't be with her. So we just wanted her home. We just wanted to be together already. And a family who makes that choice for their child, that should be supported. But no one really had clear answers for us. Workers would just kind of come for a day and then we would just get a new person the next day. I think the longest we ever had a worker was maybe 2 or 3 days, but even she had never been with a child who was dying. And so she really couldn't answer questions about what was typical. She really had just ever been with, like, elderly people, which is understandable, but at the same time, not okay.
Not okay is as kind a thing, I think, as you could describe it, because it was that's just a terrible situation. And of course, you're still right in the middle of COVID. Now, your brother and sister-in-law were there. Did you have any other people, other family members or friends that did come over during that period to give you some relief or to, help out in any way? Or was it basically you, Michael, and your brother and sister-in-law?
My husband's parents came from Omaha, Nebraska. For a couple weeks, they stayed in an Airbnb close to us so that they wouldn't be too in our space and that they would come over as needed to offer some relief. So that was very helpful. And my mom would at times come over. My parents live locally. And my mom would occasionally come over. We didn't really know what we needed at that time, to be honest. It was very hard to accept help to have space because you know that you have such limited time. That we kind of just wanted quiet. But at the same time, during that time, because she was in such pain, she became very, very angry. And I was the main person that she pushed away. And that was impossible to have, knowing that you have such limited time with your child and then for them to reject you. Reject is probably the wrong word, but she would get very, very angry at me and yell at me to leave the room when I was just wanting to be close to her. And that's not her. That's certainly not her. And that was a question that I could never get answered. Is this a typical thing of someone who is dying? Is this normal? Is this the pain? Is this the medicine? But our lack of support from hospice, I was just kind of always left questioning why these things are happening. Why is she so angry? Why is she in uncontrolled pain? Why doesn't she want to be with me? It was just kind of me and my husband trying to figure this out and navigate it on our own.
Just totally, as I said, I used the word unfathomable before. I'll use it again. Really, right from the beginning, not that any type of cancer situation is good, pediatric cancer situation. Yours is just one disappointment after another, one hardship after another. Sometimes, many times, really, during these periods, there is some levity, some good moments, some hope outside of the brief hope that you had after her immunotherapy. But the roller coaster, which sometimes I describe this as, never was a roller coaster. It basically went downhill the whole time up to and including, of course, August 11th, 2020, just before her fourth birthday, Isla passed away. And I left out a number of details that I wanted you to fill in because before the end, when she got so angry, she was quite a character. So can you talk a little bit about her? And you already mentioned what she was like in the hospital, but forgetting the anger, which was brought on by the illness, of course, I'm sure. What was she like?
So you're saying like her personality, just what was she like?
Exactly.
Being in the hospital in that intense way completely changed who she was. When she was first diagnosed, she was the second child and very quiet, very shy. She would just kind of follow her brother, do whatever he wanted, didn't really have much of a voice. When she came in that hospital, she was so doted on, so adored, given so much attention, specifically by the wonderful nurses that she was surrounded by, that it just built up this confidence in her that she just kind of exploded out of herself with personality. And she was the brightest, most hilarious, cheery child that you would ever, ever meet. Anyone who would walk into her room would just leave belly laughing. And even like quiet, reserved residents who would walk into her room, just kind of awkward. And we've all encountered residents that aren't certain of themselves at hospitals. And she would just immediately engage them and just kind of like work the room, pulling in everyone, always finding something special about anyone that would engage them. She just wanted to be everyone's friend. She talked to every single child she passed in the hallway. she would get excited whenever she saw the doctors and nurses rounding. She called it the parade every morning. And she would try to come out and join the parade with the doctors and nurses. And she just was living her best life in the hospital. She loved it. On her third birthday, she actually was home during that time. We asked her what she wanted to do for her birthday, and she wanted to go be with her friends, her hospital friends. So we brought her into the hospital, and her nurses, like, on a separate area of the hospital, threw a little party for her because she just wanted to be with her friends on her birthday. She just loved the hospital, and she would get sad when she was home for too long because it became home to her. Her and my relationship, I felt, was extra special. Just going through all that so intensely together, being in the same room all day, every day in that way, I felt like I had a really special relationship with her. And I think that's why it was so, so extra hard at the end. Because our relationship was so incredibly special. It felt almost like she was protecting me in some way to be away from her. I don't know, but
whatever it is, she sounds like an incredible, was and is, of course, still incredible. And always will be. Now you and Michael have three other children, your oldest son, Sawyer, who I believe is maybe 9 years old now, something like that.
Yep.
You also have 4-year-old Ellis and 1-year-old Arian. Both of them would not remember what Isla was like. Sawyer, of course, would. What was it like? Not that he saw her too much during the period, but what was it like for him losing his sister? And how have things gone for him since? Is he doing okay with it? Because obviously losing a sibling is, you know, a very bad situation.
Yeah. It was really a hard time. At the beginning, you could tell that he didn't fully understand the foreverness of a death. That when we told him that she would die, there's no way that a 5-year-old can fully grasp the long-term nature of that. So I think it was kind of a process for him to kind of keep revisiting and understanding how permanent the situation was and what that would actually mean for his life. I had tried to bring him to a therapist when he, a handful of months after she had passed. It was really hard to find a therapist at that time because all therapy was still online because of COVID. But for a 5-year-old, that a Zoom call is just not going to be the same. They need play therapy. They need very different things. So I found one person who was willing to take him in person, and it just didn't go well. And he told me that this person wants to talk about Isla with me, but I want to talk about Isla with you. Which is understandable, but also really hard for a parent who they themselves is still working through the loss. So it was really hard to support his needs while also caring for myself. And also taking care of our baby. He's doing okay now. We've had periods of difficulty with him, of him just kind of being sad, but not quite knowing why. It's also just been hard, the age gap between him and Ellis. They're about 5 years apart. And they are getting, as Ellis is getting older and able to interact at a different level, they are suddenly having this kind of new blossoming relationship, which is really beautiful to see. But for a very long time, it kind of felt like we had like two only childs, that the age gap was just too significant, that having a sibling wasn't really helpful to him. But he's doing much better now, I think, especially with Ellis getting bigger.
I was just really glad to hear that. I'm wondering what plans that you and Michael have to teach Ellis and Arian about Isla and maybe have them get to know her as their sister.
Yeah, we talk about her all the time. When we talk about their siblings, we always include her. I always say I have four kids. I always tell them, like, yeah, you have two brothers and a sister, and we include her in all conversations about our family. It's just what we do. It's not separated. And I think that has helped her to just be integrated into their lives, even though they're not going to know her. And especially Arlen, he was born years after she passed away. And we made him a book when I was pregnant with him. It's a little baby board book with pictures of her in it and kind of tells the story of her to him. And we read it all the time to him. So it's a very open conversation in our family. And the fact that I am working in this field, it kind of just integrates it into our daily life, the memory of her and the conversation about her.
We're not going to turn to that part of your life. And by the way, I apologize for not calling. I think I said Arian. I know it's Arlen.
Yes.
So you are now involved with the MAC Fund, which is located in Milwaukee. Started in 1976, has contributed nearly $70 million to pediatric cancer and blood disorder research. Why did you join this nonprofit, and when did you join it?
So Isla was treated at Children's Wisconsin, but the unit that she was in, it was actually called the MAC Fund Center. And it's called that because the MAC Fund has contributed so much money to research at Children's Wisconsin and the Medical College of Wisconsin that the unit is named after the MAC Fund. So that's kind of how I got introduced to it, just knowing that this is an organization that contributed so much to my child's care. And so after Isla passed, it took me quite a while to, you know, navigate through things, but I knew that this would be my life's work. That there really would be no other space for me other than working to advocate for children with pediatric cancer. And so it just made sense. It was just the right fit. It's 5 minutes away from my house. It is the organization that did so much for my child's care. And so I was able to connect with the CEO. Though the organization makes such an impact in Wisconsin, it's actually very small scale. There's only 5 employees. I am the 5th. So it is small, but it is mighty. And so I was able to connect with the CEO. And we had a number of conversations. And she has basically allowed me to create this new position to the organization. They have historically only worked in raising money for research. But I am developing an advocacy arm to the organization for the first time. So I started working for them early this year and have slowly been kind of piecing together this new position for myself.
Well, we're certainly going to be talking about several of the things that you're doing there. But before I get into that, most of the information that you've been so kind to send to me about Isla's situation came from a speech. One of the things I found astounding and very disappointing in the speech is that the state of Wisconsin, despite being the 19th out of 50 states in the nation for pediatric cancer rates, puts it in the top 38% and 8th. And it's the 8th state in the nation for pediatric leukemia, which puts it in the top 16% in the nation. And your state has given $0 to pediatric cancer research. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's horrible. I think, unfortunately, there's just simply a lack of awareness. When I have conversations with people, I always kind of like come in with my fists up wanting to, you know, protect and advocate for kids. But at the end of most conversations that I have, about this. People, I'm filled with hope when I walk away from the conversation because people care. People just don't know. And so I feel like it's my job to slowly chip away at changing that. Because I think it's horrific that we are not allocating funds for research in our state, that this is left exclusively to the private sector. The private sector can do a great deal, but not nearly, it cannot offer the stability that government funding can offer research. And that's why my primary goal right now is working to allocate funds at the state level for research in Wisconsin.
Now, I'd like to ask you about the three main focuses that I've read about, which certainly are going to, if they haven't already, contribute to Wisconsin becoming involved in this pediatric cancer fight. The first is that you're working with the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative to write children into the state cancer plan and to help develop a state plan specific to pediatric cancer. Please talk about that.
Sure. So I joined the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative earlier this year and initially attended their regional meeting. And at the time, I was the only local, representing the only local organization serving children at the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative. And I had a couple of conversations with different people from the collaborative and talking about the need to add children into the Wisconsin Cancer Plan. The cancer plan only acknowledges people ages 15 and older. All statistics regarding survivorship rates, anything, all are ages 15 plus, which is simply not right because that does not cover all of cancer in Wisconsin. So I had many conversations with them and also talked about the need for data because there's very little data here in Wisconsin to highlight where the disparities are, what the rates are, where the real issues are. So due to a lot of those conversations, the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative came out with a data brief in September and had a webinar highlighting pediatric cancer for the first time here in Wisconsin. It was a great first step, but it's certainly not enough. We need more thorough data for sure. I've recently had some conversations with them, and starting tomorrow, we're going to have our first meeting to begin not only adding kids into the Wisconsin Cancer Plan, but also creating a separate action plan specific to children in the state. The Wisconsin Cancer Plan is kind of a broader goals, but the action plan is going to be smaller, more actionable items with a tight time frame.
Now, you're working with the American Childhood Cancer Organization to help pass a bill which would help establish a state-administered trust fund for pediatric cancer research in Washington. Can you expand on that?
Yes. It would create a trust fund for children in the state of Wisconsin. So it would not be a federal bill. But it is with their What About Kids initiative. They have secured funds in 7 states so far, I believe, and are in the process of working with other states as well. The initiative is being led by the ACCO, but I have kind of brought them in, and I'm working collaboratively with them, along with a couple other organizations in the state. Little Warrior Foundation is one that's been really involved, and also Brave Lake McKenzie has been really supportive in our working group. But we have secured a champion for our bill, and right now it's in the process of having the language written, and we're hoping to get a bill number by the end of the year.
Certainly sounds promising. Now, as far as advocacy work, which of course is so important as you try to raise awareness for what's actually happened with pediatric cancer in your state, you're interviewing families throughout Wisconsin and writing their stories on Mac's social media outlet to raise awareness about childhood cancer. How's that going for you?
It's such a good experience. I mean, at a personal level, it's really wonderful to connect with families. That I feel like it's nice to be able to offer them an outlet that I didn't always feel like I had when I was going through the experience. It's really healing to hear other people talking about things that I have personally been through. And it feels like a gift to write their child's story with tenderness and care, and share it with the world. And it's a gift for the child to have their bravery written out as well.
I just think it's so important to get these stories into the public domain. You know, it's going through it privately, as you did, really more than many, you know, during Isla's battle, I'm sure was very, very difficult. And my guess would have been that if you could have spoken to others that would relate, could have related to what you were going through, there might have been somewhat, at least a little bit of an easier path, which you really had to, you and Michael had to really navigate by yourselves, really the whole time. How much now, you joined Mac earlier in the year, how much progress so far have you seen, at least from your own point of view, and what has been the reaction from some of the state administrators in Wisconsin?
Progress related to our bill?
Yes, your bill awareness, everything that you're trying to do to make it much more aware of what is happening in Wisconsin and doing something concrete about it.
It is a slow process, but it is rewarding because there is progress. It is just slow. I think the greatest progress that I have truly seen is in the Wisconsin Cancer Collaborative, having conversations with health officials and bringing awareness in that space specifically. There has been a big turnaround, and this is just an issue that was not nearly as much on their radar as it should have been. At the state level with representatives, it's slower. We have a lot of conversations and we get various, no one's going to say no to pediatric cancer. No one's going to reject us. But you can tell when people are really interested and have a heart for this. And when they're just there to check off a box. So it can feel a little more discouraging at the state level, having these conversations for sure. I think what will really show progress is when we can pass the bill and when representatives can put their signature where their mouth is and actually truly show support by signing onto a bill. But I think some of the most important work is done when building relationships with people who are working on the cancer plan and working on the day-to-day things in this space. I think that's where the most progress is shown.
In 3.5 years, roughly, since Isla passed away, and you've certainly highlighted the really terrible time that you went through almost, again, right from the beginning. How therapeutic for you has joining Mac been, and has it provided any type of relief in some way to what happened to Isla as you go on trying to advocate really in her name and in honor of her to help others who are going through somewhat of the same situation that you went through?
It has been incredibly helpful to me. I think when you go through something like this, you either hide away and have to just push it all down, or you work in this space and you kind of embrace it. And that's kind of the route that I've taken, and I can't not do anything. And this has given me the outlet that I was desperately needing. There was a lot of anger that I was feeling. This is an outlet to do something about that. None of this is fair. But the only thing that I can do is work to change it. So it has been so fulfilling. It has given a lot of purpose to me. It will not take away what has happened. It will not ease that pain in any way ever, I don't believe. But it does feel really good to connect with families who have been through this and to listen to them and to support them and to offer something that can maybe give their child a fighting chance. I think it's the best thing that I can do given what the cards that have been dealt.
I completely agree with you. And you're doing two things, really. You're certainly giving them moral support and an ear and someone to speak to who understands the other person's, very unfortunate situation. And you're trying to create something concrete, which will make a difference money-wise and interest-wise and awareness-wise in the problems of pediatric cancer, which for whatever reason, maybe until you got involved, was not going to do anything to help these kids. So I think that that's two very, very important things. Where can people get in touch with you? Your story is extremely compelling. And I think my listeners would perhaps want to get in touch with you just to commiserate maybe or contact you to speak on some level and perhaps contribute and know a little bit more about the MAC Fund. Where would be the best place to contact you?
Sure. I guess my email address is probably the best way. And that's agentry@macfund.org.
Well, as we come to the end of this, were you going to add to that?
Oh, I was just going to say I don't have like a website or anything like that. I'm not that advanced.
Well, the email address is certainly good enough. As we come to the end of this podcast, certainly my condolences on what you went through. I'll say it one more time, an unfathomable situation. But what you've done since then is to come out the other side as much as you have been able to from the grief and the shock of what went on. And you're really in the process and you got a long way to go because you have many, many years to keep Isla's legacy alive, which you're going to be doing. And you're going to be, you just joined the MAC Fund early this year. So what you're going to be doing in the future is going to be increasing the awareness and helping so many families that don't have the outlet right now to turn to, but certainly will in future years. And I want to thank you very much for coming onto my show and I wish you and your family the best of happiness and health in the future.
Thank you.
It is just so sad to hear the cruelty that pediatric cancer brings to any family. And I think that Autumn is a great example of a parent who was saddled with so many difficulties during her daughter Isla's battle, did everything possible to care for her beloved daughter during her acute myeloid leukemia fight, and is now focusing on helping others in response to what Isla was forced to endure. This is Mark Levine, and please tune in this coming Monday when I will speak with Carol Pound, who will talk about her son Max and his battle with the pediatric brain cancer, diffuse hemispheric glioma.